On our gross income or on our net income?
Well, that depends. Do you want a gross blessing or a net blessing? But seriously, when it comes to tithing, we can get lost in those details just like the Pharisees did. In the Old Testament, we actually see three tithes, one to support the priesthood, a festival tithe, and a charitable tithe that was taken once every 3 years. That means a 23 1/3% annual tithe. Now, the New Testament teaches us to be wise stewards of 100% of what God has given us. I'm Doug Floro, President and Certified Financial Planner at MFB Wealth Management. We'd love to talk with you about your giving, saving, and wise stewardship. For a free appointment, please call us at 215-723-8999.
MFB Wealth Management, 215-723-8999, and on the web at mfbwm.com. Securities and advisory services offered through Genios Wealth Management, member FINRA SIPC.
Well, good morning. Happy Saturday morning to you. My name is Doug Floro. I'm President and Certified Financial Planner at MFB Wealth Management, my father's business. And I'm going to be hosting A Balanced Life here on WFYL AM 1180 on your radio dial. And it will be the last Saturday of each month, and I'm very excited to be starting on the show. I've been here as a guest in the past, and my first time being a host. And The Balanced Life is a great show that discusses ways to balance our lives when it comes to our time, work, family, our finances, and all those opportunities that we get. But I also want to talk about how God fits in the picture, and specifically how God fits into our lives in the workplace. What's a good balance there? We want to have a good testimony, but we also want to work and be, whether we're an employer or an employee, to do a good job. And my first guest with me, I'm very excited to have attorney Bob Rust with me. Bob comes from the Lehigh Valley. He's originally from Northern Virginia. He has a great experience, a great life story, and I think he can also help us a lot to talk about some of those things about being a business owner or some of the legal aspects when you're an employee or an employer when it comes to faith in the workplace. So, Bob, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing fine, Doug. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on your program.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to join us. I love people's stories. We all go through a different journey to get to a certain place in life. We see God direct us, and we see times in our lives when we're just kind of flailing away and looking for direction. So why don't you take a few minutes and just share your story? I'm sure you didn't wake up one morning and say, hey, I want to be an attorney. I think it was probably some kind of a story behind that and a journey.
Well, as you use those words, as a youngster, if someone had told me that I would spend the great majority of my life and raise my family in Pennsylvania, I would have kind of scratched my head because my family's been from Virginia for a long, long time. In fact, I didn't even get out of the Commonwealth until my senior trip to New York City. But my story is that of coming from a good family, mother and father. I was the oldest of five, four boys and a girl. I ended up going to a school that most folks here have not heard of, but it's one of the best liberal arts teaching schools in the country. It's church-owned. It's called the University of the South. When I went, believe it or not, it was only 545 men.
Okay.
And it's still to this day one of the largest and most beautiful campuses in the country, 13,000 acres on the Cumberland Plateau of Tennessee. As I said, church school, chapel, and whole nine yards. I love the place. They decided my senior year to have a graduating senior go out and talk to kids about the school. So I worked for a year as assistant director of admissions, was going to go into the Navy, and then got recruited to a program called People to People that you may or know something about, the USS Hope, the ship that ship. It was actually a program under the USIS. Dwight Eisenhower got Joyce Hall to put it under the Hallmark Foundation. And
I never knew that. That's really interesting.
It's quite a program. And that my wife was the who's Dad was a military attaché in Bolivia and spoke excellent Spanish, was the administrative assistant to the Latin American director, and that's how we met that year when I was serving on the what was called the university program. My middle of my freshman year of law school at Vanderbilt University School of Law, we were married at Fort Benjamin Harrison, spent the next 2 years working there and going to law school.
How many years have you been married now?
We'll be married 51 years in January.
I love to ask people that have been married for a long time, I'll put you on the spot here. What's the secret to the success of your marriage? I mean, there's a lot of challenges for families, for marriages. What's the secret to your success?
Well, this might sound a bit old-fashioned, but I think it starts off with something called an oath.
Yeah. I hear that a lot. Mm-hmm. There's that commitment that failure's not an option.
Right. And you do it before the Lord, and I don't take, neither not my wife nor I took that lightly. And, of course, in any marriage, any partnership of any kind, but particularly marriage, there are times of distress, times of worry about this or that, the challenge of raising children. But we've been together now for more than a half century, and look forward to whatever the good Lord's got still in front of us.
That makes me smile. We just had our 35th.
Congratulations.
Hoping if we live another 15 years, it will hit that 50
there
mark.
You go.
That
there
is
you
admirable.
Go. There you go. 15 and much more than that.
Yeah.
At any rate, I was offered a job by a good friend in Virginia in law, but at the time, believe it or not, the offer, I think, was $4,500 a year. There was a major corporation, a Baptist-owned, very, very religiously committed, that most people may not, well, at this point, may not even remember, but it started off as Jarman Shoe Company, and then General Shoe Company, and then became a company called Genesco. And at the time, they were really making it, and they were buying up much of New York City, 5th and 6th, 7th Avenue. And they offered me a job for twice as much. So,
okay,
in labor relations, and I went through their executive training program. Went to New York City for a year, and then went to one of their divisions in New Jersey, and then finally one of their divisions here in Eastern Pennsylvania, specifically in Allentown. A couple of years later, I left and joined a fledgling financial and estate planning firm, fee for service. In other words, not commission driven.
Okay,
you were paid for your advice, and a very committed Christian ran that business. It was just three of us at the time and a very fine secretary. Before it was all said and done, we were national, and we had over 45 employees.
Wow.
So we had quite a success with that. But other partners were brought in who had other ideas in terms of the direction of the company, and their ideas were sound. But I didn't feel comfortable with where the company was going, not for any reason other than the fact that it was just not my cup of tea.
Okay.
And so I ended up leaving under very amicable terms, but as I've said often, wandered in the wilderness for a number of years, thinking that I would be able to make a living as a general practitioner, if I could use that word.
Okay.
In the area of business succession planning, right at the time that the big companies were seeing that marketplace as a real opportunity and specializing with folks in given areas. But eventually, between family and friends, kind of cajoling me and saying, look, I've been a member of the bar since 1975.
Okay.
But I used the law in practice with my clients who were chief executive officers of major corporations all over the country. And I worked with the compensation boards of these large companies. But at the urging of family and friends roughly 10 years ago, almost 10, I hung up my shingle and started.
And what year was that?
That would have been, it was 2006, so we're 2015. I'm just a few months shy of 10 years.
Okay. One of the things you mentioned was estate planning, and that's a term a lot of our listeners have probably heard before. And it sounds like something that only, you know, rich people would need because they're the only ones who would have like an estate. Can you just tell us briefly a little bit about what you mean by estate planning and maybe a bit of it from a Christian perspective?
Be glad to. I don't care what your station in life may be economically speaking. But if you have folks that depend upon you, good stewardship of your life, of your whatever you've acquired, I think it is incumbent upon you to make sure that upon either your disablement or your death, that what you have is taken care of in a proper manner and goes to the uses that you intend, whether it be your children, your grandchildren, your church, whatever it may be. If you don't do that, then the state's going to determine where your assets are going to go.
That's probably not going to be the plan that you want.
More often, 9.9 times out of 10, it will not be.
Right.
And sometimes it causes great family conflict, as it often does. But that's another reason of good stewardship. It's unfortunate, but when money is on the table, that's more often than not when stress is caused within family units as well as elsewhere. Right. And so to be able to say this is what Dad wanted or this is what Mom wanted, here it's written out and it's been notarized and it's been witnessed, then that puts a peace and a quiet to what could otherwise may be a contentious situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen that in the work that I do also. One thing that piqued my interest that you said is you have experience working with businesses. What are some of these special estate planning needs for somebody as a small business? I know a lot of small business owners, they put their whole life into it and they work and they don't even have time to think about what's going to happen when they're not there any longer. But things happen. It's not our choice where we're disabled or we die, quite frankly. And then not only is our family dependent upon us, but our business, our employees, all those types of things.
Well said, Doug. Before I speak specifically to that, let me just finish up on the point about folks with a basic will, for example. Particularly if the couple has minor children, you definitely need to have not only will, but probably a trust in place. Most of you out there may be thinking that's great to say, Bob, but that's very costly. And my response to you is that, look, you pay a premium on your house on homeowners insurance against the unlikely event of the house burning down. But if it did burn down, it would be catastrophic, and you wouldn't be in a position to be able to replace it. The same concept's true here. If you find there are a lot of good law firms out there that charge a reasonable fee, a flat fee, for two wills, for example.
Sure.
And that cost compared to what would happen if, in fact, you didn't have it in place and the expense and the money and not even to mention the grief and turmoil within the family, it's small. And you really ought to look into it. And it's very attainable and very doable. Coming back to your point, if you own a business and it's successful, even if it's just a one-man or one-woman shop or if it's just a few employees, that business is probably the number one asset that you have right. Going.
Sure.
Next being maybe your residence. And it's something that ties right back into your stewardship responsibilities as it relates to your family. If something happened to you and you were disabled, who's going to step in and who's going to run that business while you are disabled? If you die, what's to happen to the business? Is it to be sold at a fire sale because right. nobody's thought through what's going to happen? Example for myself, I've got a small law firm.
Yes.
I happen to be the prime mover right now. Hopefully, within 10 years, that won't be the case. There'll be other younger attorneys, but that's not the case right now.
Yeah.
So I've got to, for the sake of my clients, I've got to be thinking through, what if that proverbial beer truck hit me?
Yes.
So I've got a younger attorney, very committed Christian, I might add, who is working part-time with me, and we're in the process of working out where I would, through a power of attorney, he could step in if I was incapacitated. Or if I should die, he could step in as a receiver for the law firm and make sure that my clients are properly taken care of. And yet my wife's interests are watched over too.
Absolutely. Got to take care of,
right.
Biblically,
right.
of our spouses, of
right.
our families. We,
right.
we have that responsibility.
And the same thing's true of a small business owner of any kind, professional nature, tradesperson, whatever it may be. And we are so busy that we tend to say, well, I'll get to that later. It's one of those things that just keep being pushed back for a number of reasons. And again, I would just encourage the people in the audience who are business owners, if they haven't sat down.
Right.
Well, someone like you, Doug, who understands the need for a business person to plan for eventualities that may never occur, or they'll eventually occur, but may not occur for a long, long time, that they it would really be to the benefit not only of themselves, not only of their business, but also for their wife and their family.
Absolutely. One of the words that you keep using, and I love it, is stewardship. And that's a word. It's just being a manager of something that doesn't belong to us.
That's
all
correct.
These things are temporary. Mm-hmm. Whether it's our business, whether it's our wealth, whatever it is. But we're responsible to manage it in such a way that when hopefully we stand before the Lord and he says, well done, thou good and faithful servant.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to do that. So part of the balance, though, with stewardship, I find, is using our resources wisely. And I've had people say to me, well, Doug, can't I just go out and write my own will? You know, or what about these will kits and things like that? Now, I have my answer for that, which I'll share in a minute, but I'd love to hear your perspective on that issue of do it yourself.
Well, if your sink and there was a plumbing problem, would you go out and get a kit and try to do it yourself? If it was an electrical problem, would you do the same? There are far greater implications if you try to write a legal document and you do it incorrectly. But even more fundamentally, yeah, the ones that are out there, those kits, they're basically sound, but they can't talk to you.
Yeah, and there's the state-specific things,
right.
Too.
Oh,
each state's a little different because there's not a federal standard necessarily
for
writing a will.
In fact, and in this country, the law that's is in control as it relates to wills or trusts is not a federal law. It's state to state.
It's state to state. So that can vary how many signatures are required and items like that.
How many and that what type of signatures? Is witnesses got to be disinterested? Whether it needs to be notarized? Is your state a common law state? Is it a community law state?
Right.
Community property state, excuse me. South Carolina is common law, but it's significantly different in its basis and its roots than even Pennsylvania, two of the 13 original colonies. And then you get into a state like Louisiana, which is under the French administrative law, and that is, even in law school, we had a hard time figuring that law out. But yes, each one is different, and you're at your own risk if you try to do it yourself. Circling back, though, to your point about stewardship, it's not just stewardship of monetary assets or financial things. There is, people use different terms, but there are wills which conclude at the very beginning with a faith statement.
I love that. Well, tell us some more about that, because probably most people don't know that. And if they just pick an attorney out of the Yellow Pages, mm-hmm. if anybody still has a Yellow Pages at
right.
home, that attorney's not even going to bring something like that up, a statement of faith. I love that. I have that in my will. Tell us a little more about that.
That's probably one of the greatest legacies you can leave to your posterity, not just your children, but potentially many generations down the line, great-grandchildren on. And it's essentially your heartfelt statement of faith, why you feel that way, why you have your faith, and what it has meant to you, and what you hope it will mean to to those that you are leaving these words to hear. As you said earlier to me, it's maybe pray that folks hear this indeed do hear what's being said, and that's the hope here too. That it's not about the person so much that's writing it. It is he or she is trying to give glory to God. And hoping that those words are read and understood
right.
by their children and their grandchildren.
And isn't there a legal obligation actually to read the will?
Oh, very definitely, yeah. And a lot of people don't understand, but in Pennsylvania, the will is kept either by the lawyer, which mm-hmm. we don't cotton to, or by the client. And it is not operative until death. It could be changed at any time,
right?
Amended, but upon death it becomes irrevocable. And whoever's been named in that will to be the administrator or executor of that will takes it down to the local recorder of wills office in the county, and is actually sworn in as an officer of the court. Now it's a public document, and that person is given, with the power of the court, what's called short certificates or letters of administration,
okay,
and the ability to go out and then do what that will says. And a lot of other folks don't realize either that it's not a short-term process. It's at least a year. You've got to give the creditors of that estate a year's time to come forth.
Yeah.
There's a lot to it.
And it's a big deal. Yeah. It really is a big deal. And quite often, parents will put their children down as executor or executrix, and the children don't have any idea what is involved in that. It really is a big deal. It is a lot of work. And the parents, unfortunately, do not communicate. I mean, that's kind of an old way of thinking, but parents always used to hide from their kids how much money they have and assets. Well, somebody's got to find out where that stuff is, make an accounting of it, pay taxes on it. And that's another area that people get really confused about, like a death tax, inheritance tax. We have a few more minutes here before we have to take a break, but can you just tell our audience a little bit about those issues where it comes to taxes and how that would affect people?
Yes, and it goes back to your point about, you know, the do-it-yourself legal kit. Most times, mom or dad may ask, they will make themselves their particular respective
right.
executor or executrix. But the tougher question is, what if you can't do it or you're no longer here? Who would be your successor? And often it's one of the children.
Right.
And typically to Sally or to Joe, would you be willing to be the successor? Oh, sure, Mom. Sure, Dad. But they have no concept of what they're getting themselves into. It's a difficult and it's a complex, even for this most simple estate, the Pennsylvania inheritance tax, there's something, I can't remember the number of forms that you have to fill in, even if there's no taxes due because it was a marital, the husband died and everything is going to the wife. There's advertising you have to do in the legal journal and then the local paper. There's bank accounts you need to set up and there's accountings you need to give. Usually there's no federal estate tax concern because right now, at least for right now, the amount that's exempted from taxation is significant. It's going on to $10.5 million now, whereby though in the state, net of the expenses of the estate, there's going to be a 4.5% tax if it's just going to the children.
Right.
If it's going to the spouse, there's no taxes.
Correct.
But then you can work yourself from a 4.5% to a 12% to a 15%.
That is a significant amount of your estate. And that would be to those people that are not related to you, correct?
If you leave
to a friend or something like that.
Or to a collateral relative, an heir other than the most immediate heirs. And again, that's a great example of if someone dies of intestate succession, that is, without a will, that kind of taxation could occur.
Absolutely. So it's important to have a plan, to do things correctly. And Bob, we're going to have to take a short break here, but I look forward to our audience joining us as we come back on the other side there. We'll pick up the conversation and head into some new territory, too. So again, Doug Floro with The Balanced Life here on WFYL.
Be my source, be my life, Jesus.
Hi, I'm Doug Floro, President and Certified Financial Planner at MFB Wealth Management. In Matthew 25, the parable of the 10 talents warns us that not investing the master's talents because of fear is wrong. Doing nothing can be a sin.
So what are the consequences of doing nothing?
In this parable, the first thing we see is that the Lord is not pleased. The one talent is taken away and given to the one that has 10 talents. Finally, the unprofitable servant is cast into outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Wow, that sounds harsh.
It certainly does. Now, none of us is a perfect steward. But if you feel like you are just coasting along and it's time to make some changes, please call our office at 215-723-8999.
MFB Wealth Management, 215-723-8999, on the web at mfbwm.com. Securities and advisory services offered through Genios Wealth Management, member FINRA SIPC.
Good morning again, and welcome back to A Balanced Life. I'm Doug Floro, President and Certified Financial Planner at MFB Wealth Management, my father's business. Again, I'm back here with my guest today, Bob Rust, an attorney from the Lehigh Valley. We were just talking about one of those subjects nobody really likes to talk about, which is death and taxes. And those things just are classically inevitable. And they can have big impacts on not just the individual, but our families, our communities. And specifically, one of the things we wanted to talk about is for businesses. And Bob had just told us that if you leave in your will money to your family members, if they're direct descendants, you're looking at 4.5%. If it goes all the way up to 15%, that would be to people that are not related to you. One thing we did not talk about, if you leave money to a charitable organization, there's zero taxes there. So that's a nice option. But what about our folks that have a business, Bob? Let's talk about death and taxes when it comes to a business and some of the issues that can run in there. Businesses, we pay our taxes all the time and make our quarterly payments or whatever we're required to do. We pass away. What happens to our business? What's the taxes look like there?
Doug, as you well know, for a successful business, the one that is, they've really worked very hard and they've it is now much bigger in size and value, that business can be subject to a double taxation upon death. Now, one thing that recently happened within the last 10 years is that the amount of the assets of an individual, including his business assets, that would be subject to taxation, that was the exempted amount started off at $5 million per person. And if you did the right kind of planning with his wife or her husband, then you could exempt $10 million of those assets from estate taxation at the federal level. Because of inflationary adjustments, that's now closer to $10.5 million. Or $10.25 million, rather, if I remember correctly. But let's say your business has, and this is not unusual, folks now have a business that's worth $15, $20, $25, $30 million. That's not a huge business, but it's a nice business. Well, if you haven't done the proper planning, anything over that $10.25 will very quickly be subject to a tax rate that's almost half. It's 45%.
Well, how's somebody going to pay 45%? Wouldn't they have to sell the business and liquidate it?
They'd have to sell assets in order to pay the taxes if they hadn't planned, if they didn't have life insurance in it, for example, to pay taxes, or they hadn't taken other steps that, again, you, Doug, would help them do and think through to get those assets out of their estate and therefore not subject to taxation, for example, with the use of an irrevocable trust. And proper planning. Otherwise, the business may have to be sold at a fire sale because they simply can't pay those taxes.
You're making me think this through. Here, the government is coming in and taking a large part of the business, but it's not just the money; it's people's lives that are impacted. Those employees are going to lose jobs and go on unemployment or have to look for jobs just because they're coming in and collecting these taxes. That doesn't seem to be a way to build our economy and build our country up.
That's why there's a strong school of thought that says that we should do away with death taxes at the federal level altogether. And now there's a strong school of thought to the contrary, that we should not allow assets to pass from one generation to the other because it tends to be a form of empire building.
Well, what about farmers, these people that it's been in their families for 300 years? I think you told me earlier your family dates back to like 1650, right?
Yep.
And that's what this nation's been built upon.
Yes, it is. And, you know, you mentioned that if without proper planning, it's not only it's the lives of the employees, but also it's that next generation that wants to take over the business. And particularly in farming, that's one of the it's one of the most crucial concerns we have facing the country right now. The number of young people that don't that are raised on a farm but don't stay in the business.
Right.
And therefore, the farm may end up being sold, subdivided, and used for other purposes, commercial, industrial, and residential, taking great, very viable farmland out of the system. At some point in time, there's a point of no return on that. And therefore, it's vital interest to the entire society that we keep that core of agricultural families, family farm owners in place. And this ties back to your point. In order for them to do that, we've got to avoid a situation where there's confiscatory taxes to the point they have to sell off assets in order to just keep the business alive, or maybe even they just have to sell everything off and close it down.
Yeah, even a modest-sized farm, and if it's going to their children at 4.5%, that still can be significant for farmers that are just getting by.
That's a very good point, Doug. For someone who would not get hit by the federal tax but would get hit by the Pennsylvania inheritance tax. Farmers are considered often as being asset-rich in the sense of their land.
Right.
But cash poor because they're constantly having to put the cash into the seed, into the planting, into the harvesting, into the equipment, etc. So it's critical that a farm owner really sit down and think through his succession plan. And again, you talk about stewardship. This is a classic example because I just mentioned earlier there may be one or two of the children that want to stay in the business, but there may be one or two or more who do not want to be. And then the question is, how do you value that farm? Do you value it as a farm, or do you value it on the basis of what you could sell it in the open market to develop it and subdivide it?
There is a difference.
There is. And it's usually not the first generation, but it's the second generation that says, hey, wait a minute. You're valuing the farm members of the family are valuing this as a farm. But to us, if we could get hold of and have control, we could sell it for 10 times that much.
Wow.
And that's what we want to do.
Sure.
So there you go. You got a fight just ready to happen. Again, another reason why at the very beginning level, the patriarch and matriarch really need to think that through, put it in documents so that when it gets to that third generation and say, look, this is what granddad and grandmom wanted. And not only that, it's written, it's legal, it's enforceable, so back away.
Bob, we've spoken about a lot of important things here, and hopefully a couple of people have had some interest sparked, and I'll say it again at the end of the show, obviously, but how can people contact you to get professional advice on these really important issues, people that want to be wise stewards?
Well, thank you for that invitation, which I'll gladly take you up on. They can contact our office by calling 610-821-0484. I'll repeat that, 610-821-0484. And they can contact me by email at R as in Robert, N as in Nelson, R-U-S-T. That's rust, like the color of your hair, or corrosion. So it's rnrust at rustlawllc.com. rnrust at rustlawllc.com. Our website is www.rustlawllc.com, but it currently is down because we're reconfiguring it. So anybody that would like to get in touch with us, I would encourage them to either call us or email us.
Okay. And it seems like one of the unique things about your firm is you make house calls. You want to tell people about that?
Yep. Thank you. Yes. Our mantra, if you will, is the law firm with a friendly touch. We make house calls. And we do. We will go to the client, whether it be in their home or whether it be in their office. If that is their desire, They're always welcome to come to the office, but we will go to them. So that we do that because, and as you know, because you do it all the time as well, a person feels much more comfortable in their own surroundings.
Absolutely.
And that makes my job that much easier because I don't want them to feel uncomfortable or reticent to talk or speak. I'll also add that our office is not your typical law office. We had three children. They're all now out and married with their own children. We have what was called a California bi-level, and the lower level now is largely committed to the law office. So you come in, and it's almost like coming in. It is coming into someone's home, but just converted to the office. Either way, a law firm with a friendly touch.
Well, I love it. That's great. just changing gears just a little bit here. We've been talking about some of the challenges for businesses that are well established, for businesses that have a certain amount of wealth and they're concerned about taxes. What are some of the challenges that you see today for anyone that is just kind of starting out their own business? I love entrepreneurs. I firmly believe that's one of the things that made America great. It seems like it's more challenging than ever to get out there and start a business.
You're absolutely correct. The survival rate of a new startup is very, very low. And then even if successful, the transmission survival rate to the next generation is even the rate of success is even less. By the time you get to the third generation, I think it's less than 10%.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge. Yet, as you so well pointed out, Doug, it is the heart and soul of this country. It is what makes this country tick. All the talk about taxes and government would come to naught if those businesses were just magically gone. There could be nothing to tax,
yeah,
except the large corporations. And they will take care of themselves, I guarantee you.
They do take care of themselves, mm-hmm. and they partner with government. Mm-hmm. We talk about the vanishing middle class mm-hmm. in the United States. We got to build up the middle class, all the politicians. We're out there for that person. And for the most part, I don't think they really have small business interest in mind, that they partner with the large corporations. And I think the middle class in this country would be doing a lot better if we had an environment where it was more small business friendly. That these are the places where jobs are created, where families build a certain amount of wealth. Most of the small business owners that I know are middle-class folks, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. They're not the mm-hmm. fat cat rich mm-hmm. guys mm-hmm. that are out there. I know a big challenge for a lot of them is the cost of health care. What about some other challenges that you've seen? And if you have any advice on how to help us out there,
well,
that'd be great.
Yeah, no matter what your business, you're probably putting a lot of time into it. Each week, you may be, save for the Sabbath, working almost every day. What usually happens in that startup you just mentioned, Doug, is that the man or woman or the partners work like mad just to survive. And then about somewhere between the third and the fifth year, they realize, hey, we have something that's working here.
Right.
And it looks like it's going to succeed. That's the first time, maybe, that someone like yourself may come along and say to them, look, have you thought through of this thing that you're building that has value? What would happen in the event of one of you being disabled? What would happen if one of you died? Do you want the spouse of that partner to be an owner of the business? What would happen if one of you decided to leave? Those kinds of things. How do you value this business? If one of you died, would the surviving spouse feel that the value that you've placed on it is fair or not fair? Those are questions that they just haven't had time to look at.
It's so important. Let's say they make the best cupcakes in town, mm-hmm. and that's what they do. That's what their expertise is. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're great business owners mm-hmm. or great accountants mm-hmm. or attorneys or financial planners or plumbers mm-hmm. or whatever it is. I'm a big one for working with professionals, and we were talking about that before. Just the importance of doing things right, especially something as important, as we said in the earlier portion, of a will, a power of attorney, advanced health care directive. And we had spoken about do it yourself. And yeah, you can try to do it yourself, but you're taking a lot of risk. And as we get older and, you know, we have some success, we want to take some of that risk off of the table. Just one story I have from about 10 years ago, I met with a pastor, and he was just, let's say he was pretty tight with a nickel, you know. He could squeeze that pretty well. And that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. But he was very proud of this will kit that he had gotten, and he had written a will. So I just read through it. And again, I'm not an attorney. I don't read write wills, but I do read them. So I look at his will, and I said, Pastor, I see that you have your one son going to Easton, Pennsylvania, if something happens to you, to a family there, and another to Easton, Puerto Rico. And he's, what? Show me that. And I showed him, and that's what it said, because the pull-down box where you pick what state it's in, the one right under
Puerto Rico.
Is Puerto Rico. So he hadn't even realized he was sending one of his kids off to Puerto Rico. So, again, you could probably go on the internet and learn how to do an appendectomy on yourself, but I wouldn't recommend it. So I think working with professionals, other centers of influence, you know, other business owners, we can encourage one another. And I think that's so important. And just while we're kind of on that subject, another hat that you wear, and you wear many of them, is you're a founding member of Believers in Business. You want to explain some of the vision there and that networking group and what that's about?
Sure. You're a member of that as well, Doug, and you are now starting our fourth chapter. You, along with Laurie Kane and Rick Reinhardt, are starting the chapter here in Lansdale. This started off with several guys getting together at a home and challenging each other in terms of the courage or lack thereof as it relates to our prayer. Was it timid? Was it bold? Was it expectant? Or was it, I'm not so sure, but I'm going to ask kind of thing? And out of that came this concept. All of us had been involved with business networking groups prior to that.
Sure.
They tended to be expensive. They tended to be fairly demanding. They were not very collegial. We decided to experiment in setting one up. It was based on Christian principles. It would be opened and closed, and in the midpoint of the meeting, we involved with Christian prayer, that is, prayers to Christ is our Lord. And we started 3 years and 4 months ago in Allentown, and it's been blessed thus far. We're now, as you just mentioned, you're opening the fourth chapter. There, in addition to Allentown, there's Bethlehem and there's Quakertown. It's open to anyone. We've had Muslim members, we've had Jewish members, but they need to understand that the basic commitment is rooted in Christianity. And those that have joined us that are not Christian have been good members, but they did not stay. And I can understand why they may not want to. But while they were there, it was good for them, and it was good for us. But the basic idea is that in order to receive, you've got to give.
Yes.
And we do not charge we've got this core group of folks, and now you're part of that, where we're giving our time to the management and the administration. We're not charging $400, $500 a year in order to enrich someone else further up the line with line their pockets or to pay people to run it. We do it as collegially as we can. We don't know where the good Lord's going to lead this, but thus far it's been very exciting.
It is exciting, and I've been to many networking groups as a visitor, and as I often say, Believers in Business is the only meeting that I've gone to for a third meeting, because usually by the first or second meeting, I just say, why am I here? Believers in Business, I knew right away why I was there, and I'm honored to be part of a new launch in Lansdale. can you remind me what the website is? So I think that's a great way. The Believers in Business has a very good website where people can get an idea. You see where the different meetings are, when they meet, and all those types of things.
Yes, www.bib.org.
BIB.org. Right. It doesn't get much easier than that. Right. Believers in Business, BIB.org.
And we don't, again, another thing, it's a little bit different. We don't meet every week. We meet either the second or fourth Tuesday of the month, second or fourth Friday of the month, or in your case, Lansdale, now it's Wednesdays, right?
Yeah, we meet on Wednesdays. So.
And what is the second or first and third?
That would be the first and third.
First and third.
Wednesdays, yeah.
Right. Where in Bethlehem, it's the first and third Tuesdays. Just one other quick thing, Doug. It goes back to what you were questioning earlier about the importance of a business owner receiving sound counsel and having it not just from one party.
Right.
One of the biggest problems we have, whether in the secular world and in the Christian world, is the tendency for an advisor to think that the client is his, and anybody else that comes into the play may be an interloper who's to be resisted, which is the worst mistake, I think, that can be made as it relates to the interest of the client. I think that the accountant needs to work with the financial planner with the attorney with the trust officer, with the insurance professional. Easily said, but very difficult.
It is difficult. But you need a team.
You do.
And again, a small business owner, you can almost be in an echo chamber, you know, where you just keep hearing your small views on things.
Right. And to have these folks who are good play off on each other, and they're invariably going to have knowledge that the other one doesn't have, I think that's just really critical. And one other thing that's these days is now starting to be spoken of more and more. You mentioned health care. Some call it the Affordable Health Care Act. Some call it the Unaffordable Health Care Act. you reference the ability to do a business. Now, they add on to that that you've committed Christian, have basic values, very beliefs that you're not willing to compromise on. And now you have the hand of government, whether it be through the Affordable Health Care Act or be through other means, trying to get you to do something that you think you know is not right.
It's a big challenge.
It's a huge challenge, and it's another reason, as Franklin Graham has been making the call of late, for Christians to look to work with Christians, that the dollars that they spend not go to the secular world and back to the very thing that's working against them, but work with fellow Christians. That's not to be exclusive. That's not to say that you won't work with someone who is not Christian.
Of course.
But it is to say that as Christ said when he sent the disciples out, I want you to be wise as serpents and as innocent as doves. Use your head. But stay grounded in what is right and what is to the glory of God, not to the glory of yourself or others for that matter.
Yeah, unity is so important. I keep hearing that message on a Sunday morning. I don't know if that's just my church. I don't think so, because it's very important that Christians are together, that we're on the same page, that we realize that there are honestly attacks against our faith and against God. Not that we should take those things personally, but that we should be wise and realize that, and that there is a lot of value to working with other believers, whatever we are doing, and that there's a reward in that. And we need to encourage one another, because it's difficult, whether you're a single mom, whether you're a small business owner, whomever. It's tough out there.
It is. And it's not to say that because one says he or she is a Christian that they're necessarily a good person. That's as Christ has taught us. We have to be beware of the false prophet, to be discerning. But if indeed there's a fellow believer there that is committed, that has value that it's very, very difficult to overstate its importance. And we are under attack, and I'm afraid to say, we're just seeing the leading edges of it.
Yeah, in just a couple of minutes, we're going to have to wrap up here, but does anything come to mind of some specific differences that you've seen over the last 5 to 10 years as far as faith in the workplace, things that maybe you could have said years ago but now would be considered not only politically incorrect, but where you might actually have legal issues come up with
most,
your business.
Most assuredly. There has been a decided trend, and it's under the name of what you've often heard is political correctness, that has now morphed into laws that could have you arrested for a hate crime, for example. When your words are taken out of context, and that where you may differ with another in terms of their lifestyle or their beliefs, and you honestly differ, but you don't hate that other person, you don't wish them ill, you just differ with them.
Yes.
And it's getting to a point right now that if your deferral or your difference is violates what the law says is not right, you put yourself in harm's way. I know we're running out of time here.
No, that's okay. We still have a couple more minutes, and I think this is an important issue that's in the back of our minds. Again, there's a lot of risks when we start a business, and this is a new area of risk. Do you have any ways that we would say how we can mitigate these risks, where we can reduce these risks? We don't want to do anything that violates our faith, yet we do want to be compliant. I think that's part of our testimony as Christians.
It is. We are to give unto Caesar what is Caesar's. And again, another reason why you may want to give serious consideration to a Christian advisor who either has had to think all of those things through and can advise you so that you do not fall into a trap of a lawsuit because you've crossed over a particular line, or if that advisor doesn't have the specific knowledge, knows someone who does.
Sure.
I was party to a recent, one of the BIB members made me party to a recent gathering. You may have heard of it. It's called C12.
Yes, C12.
The CEO Roundtable. I spent a day with this group of business owners. And if you'd taken the Christian element out of it entirely, you would have left with a lot of valuable information as to how to protect your business as it relates to the whole question of discrimination.
Okay.
But you add the Christian element to it and the desire to maintain your principles while at the same time not discriminating against someone who doesn't agree with your principles.
Right.
That's a tight line to walk.
It is. There's a lot of risk there, and we want to be faithful. And as we said before, there's so many people that depend upon us, our families, our employees or coworkers, all these different things. And an employee can take a whole company down.
Sure can. And a good employee, unintentionally, can cause you great harm because they just don't understand or have not been properly informed as to just the use of language.
Absolutely. Any tips that you can give us then besides that for ways that we can work?
I know that everybody out there, because I do it and you do it too, Doug, your head is against the wind. You're working hard to continue to develop the business. You don't have a whole lot of time, what's called spare time.
Right.
But I just would encourage you to slow down, find, reserve some time for yourself to think about the kind of things that we've talked about. Ask yourself whether you've got a cadre of advisors that you can count upon. Ask yourself honestly whether you can afford not to have such advisors, and then act as the good Lord leads you.
Absolutely. Well, we covered a lot of subjects today, Bob. Again, thank you, Bob Rust, for being my first guest today. And again, just give that phone number so one more time we can contact you if we would need to do that.
Sure. It's 610-821-0484. 610-821-0484. And we do have clients in Montgomery County, as well as at Berks and Bucks County.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Bob. Thanks for joining me today on A Balanced Life. I hope everybody listens has a great and awesome day.
Jesus, be the center.
The Apostle Paul proclaimed in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 that we must not be sorrowful and without hope like those around us when friends and family who die in Christ go to live with Him in glory. Hello, I'm Sam Rohr, president of the American Pastors Network. In fact, we should not only not sorrow like others who have no hope, we should look forward with great anticipation to the rapture of the church when Christ himself will descend in the clouds, and all those who know Jesus Christ as Savior will hear the unmistakable sound of the archangel's trumpet. Then in that glorious moment, in a twinkling of an eye, all those who having died in Christ will be raised from the graves, and we who are alive will meet our loved ones in the air with our Lord, and together will live with him forever and ever. I'm Sam Rohr of the American Pastors Network saying, now this is real biblical hope and change that you can count on. Do you have that living hope?
Join the Pennsylvania Pastors Network at papastors.net.